Hopkins. Bryant for the win.
Interviews from your favorite local coaches and athletes.
He's getting to the basket of will, and he's hitting that three-point shot with some consistency now, and he's just in a groove right now where he's pretty well unstoppable.
Hall of Fame and legendary guests.
I was driven by loving to play, liking the challenge of being an NFL quarterback, but after 18 years, I was 1 month short of 39 years old. It's time to go.
Analysis and insight on the latest national sports topics.
Sean Payton was horrible in clock management. That should never be the case with this New Orleans Saints team.
Well, we're waiting.
Live from the Auto Farm Studios, it's Drive Time Sports with Jordan Buscarini on KOAL 107.3 FM and 7:50 AM.
We're back for more Drive Time Sports. Live from the Auto Farm Studios, I'm your host, Jordan Buscarini. Exactly 1 week away from the NFL Draft. And of course, here on KOAL, we are an affiliate of the Las Vegas Raiders and also NFL Thursday Night Football. So we will bring you a live draft show with a podium feed to Roger Goodell. So we're going to be talking a lot of the NFL draft over the next week. We'll dive more into that today. We're going to be joined by Joe Bartel. We've been joined by Joe before. He's one of the fantasy experts over at RotoWire, which I love RotoWire. I don't typically do endorsements, but I can't lie. I use RotoWire every single year when it comes time for fantasy baseball. I know a lot of people love fantasy football. I get into fantasy baseball. I play in a very deep, deep league where you almost need the help. A magazine's not going to do us any good in our league because we even draft minor league players. So you need RotoWire. Joe Bartel, terrific when it comes to football. He's going to join us on the show today. We will talk about the NFL draft. I want to dig deeper, though. We've had so many conversations about the top six picks. Yesterday, we branched off a little bit. We started talking about the Utah Utes. They have nine guys that have a great chance of hearing their name called in the draft this year. We'll talk about how free agency may have affected the draft, and we'll also take a look at the defensive side of the ball. The linebacker position fascinates me. I think there are some linebackers out there that'll go anywhere from round 3 to 5 that have very unique skill sets that will make them starters day one in the NFL. I'm talking about guys that can really make a living in pass coverage from the middle of the field. So we will talk the NFL draft. That's coming up on the show today. Also, we're going to be joined by John Pessa. You may or may not recognize that name. John Pessa was one of the driving forces behind ESPN Magazine. He's been involved with sports and sports writing for almost a little over four decades. He has a new book out. It's called Yogi, A Life Behind the Mask. It's all about Yogi Berra. Now, yesterday when we ended the show, we were talking about Jackie Robinson and it being Jackie Robinson Day, and I played the famous clip of Jackie stealing home in Game 1 of the 1955 World Series. Until his dying day, Yogi Berra claimed that Jackie Robinson was out. He wasn't out. He was safe. You can watch the video. Jackie was safe when he stole home. But nonetheless, Yogi Berra is one of the most unique players to ever suit up in Major League Baseball. This guy's a 10-time World Series champion. And when you look at what he accomplished statistically in the batter's box, it was phenomenal. He logged close to 9,000 plate appearances and struck out 414 times. It's amazing when you think about it. Batted over 300 in 1950, struck out 12 times the entire season, and Yogi was only 5'7". Yogi was one of the most fascinating players ever in Major League Baseball. And today, John Pessa, who just wrote a biography on Yogi, will join us. We'll talk about his career. That's actually going to be next segment here on Drive Time Sports. So I'm looking forward to this. Should definitely be a fun show. Let's take a look at what's happening in the national sports front. We'll begin with college football. JT Daniels, former five-star quarterback for the USC Trojans, has now entered the transfer portal. Now, it is important to note that just because an athlete goes into the transfer portal does not mean that they are leaving the school. In fact, a statement coming from head coach Clay Helton says that they're going to help him every step of the way through his decision, including keeping the option open of staying with the team. 4 to 5-star athlete, again, depending on what type of recruiting service you were looking at. top 300 prospect in the class of 2018. He's been rehabbing a knee. He's not expected to be ready for competition until at least the summer. Keaton Slova stepped in for USC and proved right out of the gate that he was more than capable of handling the load for the Trojans. He threw for 3,500 yards, 30 touchdowns, and 9 picks last year. I believe that the NCAA would allow a kid to transfer, especially with everything that's going on right now, without any penalty, right? So I do believe JT Daniels has played his last game with USC, and I don't think Trojan fans are going to be too upset about this. Although I do believe Daniels can play the game of football. I don't think there's any question about that. But that is the big news coming out of college football earlier today. There was some news out of the NBA. This broke last night, and this is going to make for a very interesting story in the future. I think not only this offseason, but going into the next couple of years. There's a kid out of California named Jalen Green, number one prospect in the 2020 ESPN 100. He is going to make the leap to the NBA Professional Pathway Program instead of going to college. The G League Initiative. Okay, they're going to pay elite prospects $500,000 plus a one-year developmental program outside of the minor league's traditional team structure. He's a potential number one overall pick in the 2021 NBA draft. He made this announcement that he's bypassing college to become the Professional Pathway's first participant. Here's the thing. There's so many questions with what's going to happen right now at the D1 level, at the school level in general. Forget about sports. Let's talk about classrooms. There's so many questions that are being asked about the fall semester. What's going to happen? And we're going to break this down tomorrow. We're going to have a couple of people join us that are definitely in the know with the process and what it looks like as far as college athletics are concerned moving into next year. But again, Jalen Green may be a trendsetter. Now, people all over social media, all over Twitter are asking the question, is the NCAA doomed because of this? No, they're not doomed because of this. Absolutely not. Kids were allowed to leave high school and go directly into the NBA draft. We saw it with Kobe and McGrady and Garnett. And I'm just listing the guys that were successful. I'm not talking about the Sebastian Telfairs of the world. All right. This happened constantly. NCAA was just fine. It's always going to have its place of relevance. But I am curious to see how many follow Jalen Green's path. So a couple of storylines developing in the college level, the college ranks. We will talk more college football a little bit later on in the show as we preview next week's NFL draft. Let's break for just a moment. A local sports update is coming your way, and then we're going to be joined by John Pessa, author of the new book, Yogi, A Life Behind the Mask. We'll dissect Yogi Berra's career, and again, some NFL draft talk coming up right here on Drive Time Sports, live from the Auto Farm Studios.
Now, this local Castle Country sports update with Jordan Buscarini from KOAL.
Reporting from the KOAL newsroom, I'm Jordan Buscarini with a look at local sports. Earlier this week, it was announced by the Utah High School Activities Association that the remainder of the spring sports seasons, including the state championships, have been canceled. The announcement was in accordance with the announcement from Governor Gary Herbert, as he announced on Tuesday that Utah schools will be closed to in-person learning for the remainder of the year. Yesterday on KOAL's Drive Time Sports, we were joined by Carbon High School Athletic Director and girls basketball coach Ted Bianco, and he talked about the inevitable announcement coming from the state and the Utah High School Activities Association.
I'm sad for our kids and all the kids around the state that are missing out on the spring sports that they love to participate in. And you know, there's so many popular things that go on in the spring for high school athletes that, you know, it ranges from soccer to track to baseball, softball, golf, tennis. I mean, there's just a variety of things going on, and we have a lot of great kids in this state that love to participate in those sports. And it's not only those sports that have been affected. It's also the other activities, state drama and our state music festivals. Those types of things have also been affected by that.
Current Utah High School Activities Association policies prohibit the use of school facilities and organizing practices or team gatherings until further notice. The UHSAA also remains optimistic that fall sports will commence as scheduled, but as Coach Bianco points out, the current restrictions could hamper the upcoming schedule for the fall sports season.
They definitely have an effect on football, but if you were to, you know, give these kids a chance to get going in right after the summer moratorium, which ends on July 4th, we have a moratorium that starts June 28th and goes through July 4th. If we could just move on from after that and get things going at that point, I do think that there needs to be a focus on, for those kids that are going to play a fall sport, I think their focus needs to be on their fall sports, and they don't need to worry about anything else that's going on with the other sports that they may be playing.
You can listen to this complete interview with Carbon High School Athletic Director Ted Bianco by visiting CastleCountryRadio.com. We will continue today with our high school season reviews, and right now we are in the middle of the fall sports season, and today we'll take a look at the Pinnacle Panther baseball team. Pinnacle finished the 2019 season with a final record of 6-17, including a 1-1 mark in the 1A state championship tournament this past October. Led by manager Jim Miller, the Panthers ended the region portion of the schedule with a 1-13 record. Competing against a quality division, the Panthers were awarded the number 12 seed in the state tournament. A 5-0 shutout victory over Intermountain Christian put the Panthers into the second round of the tournament. After receding, the Panthers ran into the eventual state champions Paiute, who delivered a 16-2 knockout blow to the Panthers. Offensively, Pinnacle was led by Isaac Arellano, who logged a .467 batting average. Stinson Mott was right behind with a .456, followed by Ja'Kai Ellington's .417. Benjamin Scott batted .400 through the year. Stinson Mott led the team in RBIs with 19, while Shaden Christensen and Mikey Vigil both logged 12. Michael Schmitz also reached double digits as he finished with 11 RBIs on the season. Christian McLean logged 3 victories for Pinnacle on the mound. Shaden Christensen had 1, and Christian McLean also led the team in strikeouts. He fanned 52 batters throughout the season. Now, as far as off-season news is concerned, it was announced on April 2nd that Ray Jones Jr. will take over the baseball program beginning in the fall of 2020. You can get your complete season review of the Pinnacle baseball season right now at CastleCountryRadio.com. Reporting from the KOAL Newsroom, I'm Jordan Buscarini.
Pitch to Bellinger. He swings and he hits a high fly ball right center field. This ball's gone!
Now 3-1 for Acuna. Swinging a high fly ball. Deep to left field. Way, way back. It's gone!
Live from the Auto Farm Studios, it's Drive Time Sports on KOAL 107.3 FM and 750 AM.
I always look forward to history lessons here on the show. Anytime we can bring in an author or an historian and teach us something, I look forward to it. There's always something to learn, especially in the game of baseball. We're going to have a history lesson right now. We're being joined over the phone by John Pessa. He's a New York Times best-selling author, and he has just released his latest work, Yogi, A Life Behind the Mask, new biography on Yogi Berra. John, it's a pleasure to get you on the show today. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's absolutely my pleasure.
Before we get started with the book, Yogi, A Life Behind the Mask, I want to get the listeners familiar with your work. I mean, you're a veteran sports writer, to say the least. You've been around for a very long time, and I think this is important to my first question. So give me a little bit of your background and your history in writing for the game of baseball.
Sure. I started in sports journalism in 1974. I'm lucky that I'm in a profession and job that has been a joy, and I'm doing something that I love. And I got my big break working for a paper in Washington, which put me on the path of becoming a sports editor in Hartford, and then later in New York at Newsday, and covering the Yankees and the Giants and the Jets and the Super Bowls. And there's not a lot of events I luckily haven't been to. One of the high points was going to the Barcelona Olympics, which was phenomenal. We were there for 22 days, and then I left. Newsday to help start ESPN Magazine, which was an incredibly interesting experience. Believe it or not, it took us almost 4 years to get the magazine off the ground. And then when we did, thankfully, people really liked it. And that was a tremendous experience. And did a big investigative look at the rise of steroids in baseball while I was there. And then after editing, turned back to writing. And a an agent in New York, literary agent, came to me and said, you know, I've been reading your stuff, and I really think you should try writing books. And I felt like this was a good time to do that. And my first book was about the labor wars and the steroid scandal and the rise of free agency and George Steinbrenner. And that one took 5 years to write. And I wanted to write something that would put a smile on people's faces after writing that book. And this one, the first thing that came to mind was Yogi Berra. And it didn't hurt that he was also my father's favorite baseball player.
That's what fascinates me about this, your entire history. I mean, you have such a detailed history in the field of sports writing, yet it was Yogi Berra that you decided to take your first major biography role on. And look, you mentioned as to why you picked Yogi. There's a lot of pressure that goes into writing a book like this, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, the first thing that people think is, okay, so there's been so many books written about Yogi and so many stories, and what could you possibly find that's new? And, you know, I've been around for a long time, and I was an editor for a long time, and, you know, everyone has a different take, and second, you just know that there's so many more stories if you spend the time. And I took 4.5 years, told a lot of the people that I knew that I was going to be wanting to talk to that I'm not here for an hour, I'm here for 3-4 years. And I got to know bunch of people in Yogi's family very well. I got to know older Yankees that I grew up watching very well. And, people start telling stories and get past the first level, you get down to the second and the third level. And, you know, the stories are fascinating, and you really get a much clearer idea of who Yogi is. And I don't think that people think, when they first think of Yogi Berra, that he was a complex, complicated man, but he was. There were so many levels to him, and the big pressure, that especially on a biography, is it's my responsibility to tell people about the life of someone else, and you really want to make sure that you get it right, and I'm hoping that I did.
Again, our guest right now is John Pesce. He is the author of the new book, Yogi, A Life Behind the Mask, which is available right now. John, let's start by talking about the career of Yogi Berra. If you just go down a list of his accomplishments, I mean, it's absolutely unbelievable. Here's a guy that played in 18 All-Star games. He was a 15-time All-Star selection, career batting average of .285, one of only six players to win the AL MVP three times. I mean, he caught 173 shutouts just in that little breath, not even to mention a 10-time World Series champ. That's historical. Cool. When you just talk about the accomplishments, and that's just a few off the top of my head.
Yeah, and it goes on and on. I mean, I'll give you one year that really puts Yogi's career in perspective. In 1950, he hits 28 home runs, backs in 124 runs, bats .322, and he strikes out 12 times. Major League Baseball players strike out 12 times in 5 games.
Right.
And that was the entire season. In 17 seasons with the Yankees, full season, he struck out 410 times. And this is also a guy who played the most complicated position on the field, the only position where you see and are responsible of knowing what everyone's going to do if the ball gets hit to them. Has to be a psychologist to manage a pitching staff of high-strung pitchers, has to be a great defensive player, has to call a game, has to have a great arm, and has to be squatting down in the in the summer heat, especially in those days where they played a lot of day games. And Casey Stengel caught him in for about a 6-year stretch for an average of 145 out of 154 games a year. He caught 20 doubleheaders every year, back-to-back doubleheaders in September. And through it all, performed amazingly. And when Casey Stengel is asked, why do you play Yogi so much? And he says, when I play Mr. Berra behind the plate, we win World Series. Nice. And they did.
It's factual. It's factual.
To be exact.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, the amount of time he spent behind home plate, what was it, 1962? He cut an entire 22-inning game.
At age 37.
Remarkable, isn't it?
You know, he was at that point, this is towards the, that was his last full year as a player. The next year he was a player coach and knew that he was going to be managing the next year in the secret deal that the Yankees had made with him. And this is in June of 62 and 22 innings. I saw that game and it ended on a home run by the substitute center fielder for Mickey Mantle, a guy named Jake Reed. And everyone figured, oh, Yogi, you know, he's not going to get out of bed the next day, and you know, made all these kinds of jokes. And Yogi, he was always an early riser, 6:30 in the morning, he's there for breakfast. And you know, he was a remarkable physical specimen, he really was.
Yeah, when you talk about what he managed to accomplish in the box or behind home plate, I guess one of the things that interests me so much is when you look at Yogi from a stature standpoint, we're talking about a guy that was just a hair over 5'7", right? And this is a guy that was a power hitter. He would actually do a lot of damage outside of the strike zone, and he had wide range behind the plate. It's phenomenal for a guy this size.
Right. He was, standing up straight, Yogi was about 5'7 and a half. Thickly muscled, though. He was a solid 180 pounds, thick wrist, very powerful wrist. The first time his very first game, when he came up seven games in 1946 at the end of the season, and this was one of the rare bad Yankee seasons. They were out of the pennant race, and it actually had changed managers several times during the season. And Yogi gets up there, and he's swinging three bats in the on-deck circle. And Joe DiMaggio, who was the measure of every baseball player, is sitting in the dugout and looking at him going, you know, what is this, a showboat? What do we have here? And the second time up, the pitcher throws him a curveball about half a foot off the plate, and Yogi reaches out and pulls it into the right field stands. And Joe DiMaggio tells reporters after the game, he's like, I couldn't even hit that pitch, and he hit it for a home run. We have something here. So, you know, he was right from the start a tremendous hitter. He wasn't much of a catcher for the first 2 years of his career. No one really taught Yogi how to catch. And when Bucky Harris was fired in the disagreement with the general manager, George Weiss, Casey Stengel is hired, and he brings in Hall of Fame catcher Bill Dickey to teach Yogi how to catch. And for every day after workouts in spring training, he worked with Yogi for 2 hours in Florida heat, and taught him as Yogi said, he taught me his experience. And by the end of spring training, Dickey said, look, he's not just going to be a good catcher. He's going to be the best catcher in the league. And Dickey was right.
Again, our guest right now is John Pessa. We're talking about his new book, Yogi, A Life Behind the Mask. John, especially with your background in New York, when you figure that Yogi Berra appeared as a player, a coach, or a manager in 13 World Series victories for New York between, 1947 all the way to 1980-81, it's pretty phenomenal. When you look at what he means to the New York sports landscape, can you put that into words?
Yeah, you know, I mean, everybody appreciates the fact that he won, and everyone, you know, has their favorite moments, and certainly the Don Larson game was a big one, and World Series home runs, and there's so many games to pick from, but I think that people just, you know, they related to Yogi, and you know, Yogi was was not someone who was, you know, had the arrogance of a Joe DiMaggio, or someone who tried to push the fans away like Mickey Mantle. I mean, Yogi was just a regular guy who was just was so happy to be able to do what he liked to do, and people related to him. And he's probably the most beloved Yankee of all time. And that's saying something when you look at that franchise.
No question at all. So when you put this work together, and again, the book, Yogi, A Life Behind the Mask, and you put all this work together, we could talk about Yogi's career, but you did mention what a complex man he really was. So when you put the stories together of Yogi away from the baseball field, what was that like, and what did you kind of determine, or what did you learn from that aspect?
Well, you know, it was often said that Yogi faced a lot of verbal abuse from players. He was called the ugliest man in baseball. The writers and opposing players and management and even writers and headlines in the New York Times would call him the ape and nature boy and Quasimodo. His heritage, I mean, growing up Italian in the 30s, 40s, and 50s in this country, there was a lot of discrimination against Italians. And so he faced a lot of adversity and a lot of people who told him that he was never going to make it in baseball. And his very first manager saw how the fans were getting on Yogi and how Yogi was getting really upset, and they said, and the manager told him, listen, you're really good, you're going to get a lot of abuse, and he said this in the context of the times, especially because you're Italian, and if you let people see that it's bothering you, it's only going to get worse. So, you know, just act like it's just going to roll off your back. And he put on a good act because he didn't react to it. He just, you know, kept playing. But it did bother him, and he did internalize it, and it did hurt. And if you read, I read Yogi's autobiography, and the very first thing he writes about, very first paragraph, is about how much he hated the caricature of himself. And that's not, when he looked in the mirror, that's not the person he saw. And he saw a good baseball player and a family man and a good businessman who's made a nice living for himself. And, you know, so much, you know, I don't think people realize just how much the abuse and the discrimination he faced bothered and affected him, as it would all of us. I think that was also one of the real drives for him to manage, especially the last job he took, which he never should have taken, because George Steinbrenner in the 80s was just a bear to work for. I mean, he was firing two and three managers a year. And I was a sports editor at the time covering the Yankees, and I had a hard time hiring Yankee writers because nobody wanted to cover this team. Because you didn't cover baseball, you covered a soap opera. But I think he really, really wanted to win a World Series to prove that how smart he really was, and that because, you know, he can't be dumb and win a World Series as a manager.
No, it's very true. And as far as his past his playing days, if we're talking about being a coach or a manager, I mean, multiple stints as a manager with the Yankees. He had a stint as a coach as well for a little while, also the Mets and the Astros. Did you get a sense for a particular season or maybe a particular stint that was most satisfying for Yogi as a coach or a manager?
But he came back, they hadn't won since he left. In 1976, Billy, who was a friend, Billy Martin, managed them to the World Series. And from 76 until 83, he was a coach. And he was kind of looked at as the tranquility coach, that all the players came to him who were getting, you know, beat up by, you know, in the press by George Steinbrenner. And it was difficult playing on those teams. I mean, between Billy and George, it was, I was around those teams a lot. It was kind of crazy. So I think he really valued his role in the players, you know, loved coming and talking to Yogi. And the longer he was around, the more the players respected and loved him. And I think when he came back after George, you know, apologized and they ended up being close friends, he would go down to spring training to be a spring training instructor, and he wanted to instruct. He wasn't there to be, you know, a Hall of Famer and just hang out. And he absolutely loved those teams. And, you know, from 99, when he's 2000 to 2000, I think the last time he was there was 2010. And, you know, he coached with Ron Guidry, who became very close with him, and Goose Gossage and the players. And he loved helping players get better. And I think those kind of things were really dear to him.
John, one last question as far as Yogi is concerned. I'm sure in the 4 years that you took to put this book together, you had to come across a Yogiism that at least made you chuckle more than the others, I would assume.
Well, there were so many, and I think the one that really hit me the most was I never said everything that I said. And because it's so, first of all, it's kind of funny. Second of all, it's so right because, you know, so much of, so many of the things that was attributed to Yogi, Yogi probably himself estimated, well, you know, 25 to 30% of the things I said, absolutely. Another 30% of it, you know, I said something and probably my friend Joe Garagiola or some of the writers embellished. And then there was probably about 20% of the things that I just never said. so I think that one was both endearing and also very accurate.
Again, John Pessa, our guest. The book is called Yogi, A Life Behind the Mask. John, I really appreciate you taking out the time to join us today. Before I let you go, please give me all the information that the listeners may need to follow some of your work and, of course, get a copy of the book, Yogi, A Life Behind the Mask.
Sure. I mean, if you just visit my website, which is my name, JONPESSAH.com, there'll be links to the book and my first book and also some of the other things I wrote when I was at ESPN Magazine, and that's probably the best place to go. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Walmart, Target, anywhere where you buy your books online, which is where most of us, especially here in New York, are buying our books these days, since there are no bookstores that are open. Those are all the places that you can get the book.
John, I definitely enjoyed the conversation. Thank you again very much for the time, and congratulations on just a beautiful piece of work.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
We've got a break for just a moment. When we come back, we're going to talk NFL draft 1 week away. We'll dive a little bit deeper and talk about some depth in this draft. That's coming up next right here on Drive Time Sports.
What's up?
Kicked off by Simmons, and he'll return it left side of the end zone. Touchdown, Isaiah Simmons, the pick six.
Burrow, play action, tosses into the end zone. Terrace Marshall, all by his lonesome. Touchdown, Tiger!
You want to know more?
Welcome back to Drive Time Sports on KOAL 107.3 FM and 750 AM.
We're back on Drive Time Sports, live from the Auto Farm Studios, 107.3 FM and 7:50 AM. We are exactly 1 week away from the NFL Draft. We talked about it in depth yesterday. We focused on the Utah Utes. You know, we have 9 players from the Utes that may just hear their name called next week during the draft, which is a huge, huge number. Let's talk about how the offseason may have affected the draft and maybe some sleepers that you got to pay attention to. Very excited to bring in our next guest. We have had him on the show before, Joe Bartel. He's the operational specialist with RotoWire. We'll talk more about RotoWire and what it can do for you as far as fantasy sports is included as well. Joe, it's always a pleasure. I appreciate you joining us today. Thank you.
Yeah, it's great to talk some sports. I know everything going on right now in the world is kind of hectic, but even during the off season or draft lead up period, it's still a lot of great conversation we could have. So I'm excited to break it down.
Yeah, no doubt. And look, as far as the NFL is concerned, the offseason really writes stories for us on a daily basis, right? I mean, I've had people ask me, what are you talking about right now with no sports? How difficult is your job? And I got to tell them, for one, it's easy because they got guys like Joe Bartel who will join the show. But on top of that, the NFL really writes storylines for us to discuss when there's nothing going on.
Oh, right. I mean, Bill O'Brien is doing it all on his own with how idiotic he seems to be running the Texans front office overall. So yeah, you're right. And the NFL is just kind of rolling. They're loving this. And I it's a horrible thing to say, but they're front and center. There isn't anybody else that can really match what the NFL can provide. And we already knew that. I mean, the NFL is at this point 365 days a year operating as the number one sport in America. And baseball tries to take it away every once in a while, certainly the postseason. It feels like that's the biggest time for baseball, and the NBA does the same thing, and especially around the trade deadline, it feels like that's when they can grab the most people. But the NFL has everyone's attention, and they certainly do now when we're all quarantined and there's many other sports going on. So it's a big time, and you have these conversations. Okay, is the draft going to happen? Or, all right, it is going to happen. Is Dave Gettleman going to have to pick online? That's going to be funny to watch, too. Like, there's a lot of different storylines within the draft itself, but the offseason and how the NFL has really decided to play it out and operate with certain players being maybe less valuable than others has been a really key point for me to watch, and I've been enjoying it in quarantine here in Wisconsin, watching how the NFL kind of operates in this weird time period.
Yeah, I know you're a big Packer guy. Okay, and so I guess we can start with this right here. I love what the Packers have as far as Matt LaFleur. I was a believer in him before the Packers gave him the reins as head coach. But there has been some rumblings about the different directions that the Packers could go in the NFL draft. So let me throw this scenario out there for you. How excited would you be as a Green Bay Packer fan if the Packers somehow found a way to land Jordan Love, who obviously has an interest, he's a person of interest here in Utah, coming out of Utah State? Would you be happy with that?
Oh, that's an interesting one, and I've heard that a few times. So obviously, as a Packers fan, Aaron Rodgers was able to sit behind Favre for a couple of years, and I do think that was a reason why he's been as successful as he would be. If you're drafting Jordan Love, I have to imagine that he's going to be sitting behind Rodgers for a couple of years. That works, and I wish more teams would do that. I understand the immediate impact the first-round pick needs to have, so I get it. I understand. But I think there is some level of reliability that can happen when you have a young player that says, okay, hey, I'm going to work behind one of the best in the league. We saw it with Daniel Jones a little bit and Eli Manning, the Giants, last year. And I think that helps. It takes away the pressure. You're always going to have pressure as a first-round pick, but if you don't have to start immediately, make a difference immediately, that's a huge thing. We saw with Dwayne Haskins in the reverse with the Redskins, right, where he had to be the guy that really led the charge for that team, and there was questions about what his leadership skills were. We saw him celebrating with fans and didn't take the knee, right? Like, all these question marks happen when you are a younger player, but you can mitigate that, take that away when they're benched or they're kind of working behind somebody else. So I would be fine with that. I think the Packers have bigger needs, though, and maybe if you're telling me, okay, they'll trade back into the first round with one of those last picks, the Chiefs certainly don't seem to need that 32nd pick overall. The 49ers have two first-round picks, 31 being another one that maybe you could trade into. And you get that fifth-year eligibility option for a guy like, I think Justin Jefferson makes a lot of sense. But you can get him late in the first round, whereas I think Jordan Love is going to be taking the first 20 to 25 picks at minimum because that quarterback position is so important. The only problem is there's a lot of other teams that also need quarterbacks, and I feel like, again, where the Packers are right now, they were in the NFC Championship game despite, of course, getting demolished and breaking my heart last year. They did get there, and I think they're only a few key pieces away, linebacker, wide receiver in particular, that could make a big difference. So if we could get a guy like Kenneth Murray or Patrick Queen and then a receiver, I would prefer that option as opposed to going quarterback. But just like Rodgers, he fell to a point where it just made sense, and if that's the case for Jordan Love too, I would be all for it. I just want to make sure we get the other needs addressed as well.
You bring up Patrick Queen, and this is a name that I really like. There's a couple of linebackers in this class that really intrigue me, and I don't know where Patrick Queen falls. If we're talking about him at the end of the first round, if we're talking about an early second-round draft pick, but the fact of the matter is here's a kid out of LSU, 6'2", 230 pounds. He is terrific in pass coverage, and I think that's going to be the maybe the reoccurring theme when we talk about linebackers in this draft, especially with the way that the game is going. When you talk about Patrick Queen, this is a guy that is excellent in pass coverage, and there's a couple of linebackers that maybe could go between rounds 2 and 4 that have that ability. Patrick Queen's a very interesting player, I think, going into this draft.
Oh yeah, I would be very disappointed if Patrick Queen was available at pick 30 and the Packers didn't go that route, which means almost for certain that's what's going to happen. I can say that because I was hoping for Curtis Mosley back in the day. The Packers had a chance to take him, opted to go a different direction. I was very disappointed when we ended up trading for Jair Alexander, trading back, and not taking Derwin James with the Chargers, too. So like I can say this for certain. If a guy that I really want is there against the Packers, aren't going to take him. But you look at Patrick Queen overall, and I think, again, you pointed out, the coverage aspect is huge. He's just a difference maker. And I think if you look at the NFL overall and you see all these teams out there, there's very few difference maker middle linebackers available right now. And maybe it's just a point where in high school or whatever else, these guys are being moved to edge or defensive end and trying to make plays with the sacking and rushing the quarterback. But I think there's a real avenue for the NFL to change, especially with how pass happy it's gotten, to have guys be so good in the coverage that they make a difference elsewhere. And I think of, like, Luke Kuechly, for example, was a fantastic coverage linebacker. That's what made him so valuable, and he always made plays around the field. I think that's what a guy like Patrick Queen could do. He's not going to be a Luke Kuechly, but those types of players are really impactful, and I think it undervalued, at least what we've seen from NFL circles, when they probably shouldn't be, given how pass-happy it's turned into the game.
Again, Joe Bartel right now of RotoWire, our guest as we talk about the NFL draft. You know, you mentioned pass coverage as far as linebackers are concerned. And here's two guys that are, in my mind, on the complete opposite end of the spectrum in that particular regard. You take a kid like Jordan Brooks, probably a second-round pick. It's going to take some time for him to adapt into that pass coverage. On the flip side of that, you take a kid from Oregon and Troy Dye, a kid that we've been very familiar with over the last 4 years here in Pac-12 country. This kid is phenomenal in pass coverage, but does lack a little bit of the physical skills. And so that's why the linebacker position for me is the most interesting going into this draft. How does a kid like Troy Dye, who maybe lacks some of the intangibles but is terrific in pass coverage, does that improve his stock at all? And then again, as I mentioned, a kid like Jordan Brooks, who is phenomenal, but you know, he lacks a little bit of that.
Well, you know, I think it depends on what team they go to, right? Like if you're getting drafted by the Patriots and you're an outside linebacker that has a one defined skill, you're going to be successful because they put you in a position to be successful. If you're going to the Bears, and I hate saying this as a Packers fan, but the Bears do the same thing too. They are able to make their defensive talent, Mr. Trubisky doesn't count, their defensive talent work with their scheme. So that's where, when you look at two of those places guys mentioned, it all depends on where they go. If you say put them in Miami, where there just isn't a lot of defined roles for the team, and they did great, Brian Flores really did a good job turning the team around in the second half, there's a lot of, all right, prove it, let's see what you guys can do, and I don't know if they would flourish in that time of in that type of system or format. So that's where I get concerned. When I look at like the Chasing guy or Chase guy, I always say his name wrong, who's being projected as a early or I guess mid to late first round pick from LSU. That's where, okay, you can see a lot of teams be just enamored with the skill set that he has when he hasn't really put it on the field. I feel less comfortable with those types of players than the two names that you mentioned. I think, again, if they have a defined skill set, you can put them to be in a successful spot. They might not be, you know, 14 sack guys or get four or five forced fumbles and just make ridiculous plays. That's not what you're asking them to do when they have a type of skill set. Whereas Chasen is going to be a different kind of player, and I think it could take some time to develop, yet the intangibles are there, and it's hard to ignore them.
Joe Bartel, again, our guest right now. Joe, let's talk about the running back position going into the draft. This is a market that is so unpredictable. Remember, it was unfashionable to draft a running back inside the top 10 there for a couple of seasons. The Rams do it with Gurley. They have some success early on, and then Ezekiel Elliott goes top four, and the Cowboys have had success with Zeke. And then it looks like maybe the running back market's going to die a little bit. The contracts do not look great as far as Gurley is concerned. The Rams eat a lot of money. The same can be said for the Jets with Le'Veon Bell. But then you see the Panthers make Christian McCaffrey the highest paid running back in the history of the NFL. And so I always try to judge this based off like stock markets. Right, if you're going to look at the way a position is rolling, is it buy now, is it sell now? But still, this is a very interesting running back class going into it, and really I could see two running backs going in the first round this year.
Well, and you're talking to somebody that lives in Madison, Wisconsin, so you know I'm in on Jonathan Taylor, and I've been saying for years now that he's one of the best running backs that's coming out of the class, and I think he's going to be the best running back. And that's not to dismiss a guy like DeAndre Swift or Dobbins, who I both think are tremendous players. It's interesting. You bring up the stock market for the running backs, and I hadn't thought about it like that, but it's a great comparison. It's probably a buy-low situation right now because you have at least four prospects. I think Clyde Hare can do a lot of things like Alvin Kamara. He's not Alvin Kamara, but can do a lot of those types of things, and that's a valuable commodity to have too. But again, just like those outside linebackers we were talking about earlier, they have to have a situation that works out for them. Taylor can do everything. I'm convinced that he's going to be a guy that catch passes and run really effectively. Yes, he has miles on the tires, and I get it. That can be a concern for some people. But you're talking about at least 4 or 5 years where he can be an effective player, and we've seen it against the top competition in a spot where you're like, all right, Badgers will be just running the ball 24-7, 100%. And Jonathan Taylor is still ripping off 200-yard games. He's got the speed and athleticism to be an effective running back at the NFL level for a lot of years in my mind. And I think DeAndre Swift and Dobbins can do the same thing. Those are three elite talents, and I think each one of them has a chance, if a team wants to get that fifth year, to be first-round talents and be first-round guys. But I don't think the running back position has had that type of level, this depth, at least top-heavy depth, in some time. So that's where maybe late first-round, early second-round, we're going to see three or four guys go. whereas in past years, the position was already being devalued, but there just weren't these prospects that we're seeing this year.
You know what makes this terrifying? I think for a lot of teams in the league, okay, you talk about buying low, and I agree with you 100%. When you take a look at some of the teams that are in the back half of the first round, let's just take a look at the final six or seven picks. I mean, you have Seattle. You have Baltimore. Kansas City's obviously going to be picking 32. You have the Titans. It's really interesting with what the market has now done to Derrick Henry based off the McCaffrey deal. You have your Packers. You have the 49ers. You have a lot of teams that could actually take that risk of buying low, right? And it's terrifying to think about a talent like a Jonathan Taylor in Baltimore with Mark Ingram. That's terrifying.
Oh, yeah. And we've had Jonathan Taylor booked in our RotoWire mock drafts now for the last three editions. To Kansas City. I mean, Baltimore is terrifying. Can you imagine him with the Chiefs? That's where we're talking, at least from a fantasy perspective, that Jonathan Taylor, and I've done a few Dynasty League drafts so far and also a few best ball leagues where it's just it takes the best scores each week and you don't have to do any sort of lineup stuff. Jonathan Taylor's going in the second or third round, and I think it makes sense. And if he goes to a team like the Chiefs and he is deemed the guy over Damian Williams, and Andy Reid comes out and says, hey, we'll give him Taylor 200-plus touches and he's going to see the field for at least 60-70% of the time. In that offense, how can you not have him as a second or third round talent? So it's going to be really interesting to see. And there are situations, you mentioned the Ravens, Mark Ingram not getting any younger, right? And much of these teams have made it so far in the playoffs last year. Titans are a great example, but the 49ers, too, were super dependent on their running game. We know that the NFL is reactionary, and what happened this past year is the most important thing for most teams. I would not be surprised at all if there's going to be perhaps an overemphasis on the running back position. And it wouldn't make sense most years, but you have three or four names that I mentioned earlier that can be difference makers. And I think that's where it's different than past seasons, where maybe they do overreach and take a guy late first round, early second round, but they're going to make an impact because they're just so good in Swift, Taylor, and Dobbins.
Joe Bartella, get a RotoWire right now. Joe, before I let you go, give me the most interesting storyline in your mind going into the draft. And it doesn't have to be something that's being widely talked about. It doesn't have to be about who jumps into the top five. I don't care if this is a seventh round pick, a sixth round pick, a total sleeper. What's the most interesting storyline for you going into the draft?
For me, and this comes from a fantasy perspective, but it's going to be what happens to the wide receivers. And we've had a lot of internal debate at RotoWire and some articles and podcasts as well, talking about the draft and what it means. And knowing how good this receiver class is, and I think we're going to see in the next 10 years or so, this is going to be one of the best receiver classes of all time. I feel confident saying that now. But like guys like Jerry Jeudy and CeeDee Lamb are top-level talents that are probably going to be pushed down to picks 10, 15, 20 because there isn't as much of a need knowing there are so many other great receivers available. So because this class is so deep and the free agency class wasn't very good and we saw the NFL really be stingent on it, right? Guys like Robbie Anderson and Breshad Perriman didn't get as big a deal as we thought they might because everyone was anticipating this class. But does that mean they're going to wait in the draft or are they going to be aggressive in trying to get these top-level guys? Justin Jefferson probably should be more of a top 15 pick in different classes, but he might fall out of the first round with how deep this class is. Henry Ruggs is so good because he's fast. We saw John Roska take it so high because of that. He's maybe the third best receiver in this class because CeeDee Lamb and Jerry Jeudy are so good. So what happens to these receivers? And I'm thinking like Brandon Ayuk, where does he end up taken? Or Donovan Peoples-Jones, right? Like these athletic, talented guys that would normally be at least first-round talent, maybe late first-round, but at least first-round talent, getting pushed so far down. Will the NFL teams be aggressive in trying to acquire the wide receiver talent or play it safe and see guys that are maybe better than they should be for the draft stock fall lower?
Again, Joe Bartell of RotoWire. I've talked about this several times here on the show. I'm an avid fantasy baseball player. I highly recommend the RotoWire app. It's a must if you play in a deep baseball league. Joe, of course, you put an emphasis on football as well. Let the people know everything about RotoWire and some of the things that you guys put an emphasis on to help fantasy sports players on a daily basis.
Yeah, I mean, I can only speak on behalf of what I do. So I'm the operations specialist at RotoWire. That title could probably spend 15 minutes being talked about, but I do Ask an Expert features on the RotoWire site. So if you are a subscriber to RotoWire, And certainly feel free to. We have content going on every day, despite everything that's going on with sports right now, whether the articles or updates on players or whatever else. You have the ability to go ahead and ask questions about your deep dynasty baseball leagues or football or whatever else. And I'm on the computer daily answering questions from users that might be more difficult, that might not be completely focused for what you're tailored to. And that's where I come into play, and a few of my other colleagues are able to answer those questions as well. And we have apps that are being worked on right now for the NFL season. We've got projections set and I think also being tinkered with up-to-date news on what's going to happen with baseball and NFL and NBA too. And this gets applied to not just those sports, but I know that Premier League is getting started over in Europe too. Like if you're interested in soccer or you want to get into more DFS circles, we have a lot of different articles covered for you, including eSports, which is also another title of mine too. I am the eSports editor at RotoWire. So there's a lot of different things that we're doing to help people get through this time without traditional sports happening for the most part, and we're still updating everybody on all the news that is occurring, despite maybe being a little bit less than we would expect it in May.
Joe, it's always a pleasure to get you on the show. I appreciate the time once again. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
We are out of time on this edition of Drive Time Sports and went by in a hurry. I got to thank Joe Bartel and also John Pessa for taking out the time to join us. Do not forget, you can listen to Drive Time Sports on demand at CastleCountryRadio.com. Be safe. I am out.